front against which this campaign was devised by General Von Wynn Jopp, was temporal and internally political. That is, he was working against time, trying to cope with what could be for him in the long run a hopelessly, strategically hopeless situation in which American firepower ate deeper and deeper into his already limited reserves of men and arms. And increasingly, Jopp faced open opposition to his strategy, both from the PAVN and the PLAF unit commanders in the South, whose toe-to-toe slugging matches with the Americans and the South Vietnamese were extracting fearful casualties, and from, and in Hanoi, from fellow members in the Politburo, whose impatience was understandable, considering, as we saw last time, that only 18 months before, they had seen themselves at the gates of victory. And now, suddenly, and rather inexplicably, the gates of victory were a long way down the road. There was a kind of sense of impotency, I would say, that haunted General Jopp and the PAVN High Command throughout the war in this, in one sector, which had to do with military technology. Through no fault of their own, really, they were unable to match the military hardware of the Americans, this enormous firepower that they had at their command. Mobility was provided by the helicopter and the instantaneous communication system. It generally made things much easier to do. They tried to make up for this in various ways. It was quite evident to us in Saigon, I think we sort of backed into this, but I remember when the Hotel Metropole was bombed, a PLAF sapper ran into the lobby with a bucket of plastique and pulled the switch and ran out, and it blew up the front end of the building and with quite a few casualties. And we did an extensive analysis of Radio Hanoi's public treatment of this. And it was the assertion that that the people who were living in the Hotel Metropole, which was a military billet in downtown Saigon, were these bomber pilots who were daily hitting North Vietnam, helicopter pilots who were out shooting up the countryside, that this is the one, this was the target, and these were the people who lived in the hotel. And we knew that this was patently not true. The bomber pilots, for the most part, lived in Guam, and the helicopter pilots mostly lived out at Tanzanot or elsewhere. What lived in the Hotel Metropole were mostly Navy enlisted men, logistics personnel, the bartenders at the officers' club, the clerks at the PX, the that sort of people. So we did some analysis to why would this communist propaganda, incidentally, is not calculatedly lying as fascist propaganda is. There is a basic truth in communist propaganda or communist output, providing you accept certain definitions of terms. But you don't get the so-called big lie that you commonly get in fascist propaganda. So anytime there is a open-faced lie, something you absolutely know is not true, it's very important to go back and analyze why this is, because there had to be some specific motive for it. And it was obvious in this case that it was this sense of impotency, not being able to do anything about air power, that and the Radio Liberation and Radio Hanoi was mainly broadcasting to their own people. They were not broadcasting to the outside world. So what they were saying to them is there is a way to deal with this air power. We can go to the very lair of the pilots themselves and we can destroy them there. And I think it's illustrative, and the point of this is that they're trying to say to themselves and convince themselves that there is a sort of strategic answer, a strategic response to air power, which you can make when you don't have air power of your own, you don't have anti-aircraft weapons and so on. This was also, this lack of this inability to match Western technology was also very evident in the case of the naval, U.S. naval air power and sea power being used against both North and South Vietnam, in North and South Vietnam. The Navy had two, U.S. Navy had two task force, what called Yankee Station and Dixie Station. And these did naval shelling with 16-inch guns. They did there was carrier-based airplanes that hit North Vietnam mainly. And it was almost impossible for the North Vietnamese to devise any kind of a means, strategic means of coping with this. And there were ways that they could have done it, that is, if they had the right weapons. The highest level North Vietnamese military I ever talked to, a POW, was a general, a equivalent of brigadier general. And he was, unfortunately, a logistics general, so he knew a lot about hardware and so on, but not much about politics and the Politburo and the sort of thing I was interested in. But I remember him getting quite exercised about the failure of the Soviets to supply them with anti-ground to ground or shore to sea missiles that they could use against the Americans. He said that this that they have given them to Nasser in Cairo in Egypt, they've given them Ben Bella in Tunisia, but they have not given them to us. And I said, well, that's because they don't want to get into a weapons confrontation with the United States. It doesn't make any difference. He said they should be supporting the revolution. We're taking heavy casualties, and the Russians are just, you know, just nominally supporting us. So, again, another example is kind of sense of impotency that was prevalent in some respects throughout all the war, and which very sharply and in a very major way conditioned the kind of strategic response which the other side devised. Obviously, if you cannot deal with air power in a kind of frontal manner, then you have to devise another kind of strategy in which you can still win, according to your hopes, without use of air power. So this developed through 1967, particularly. The American planes were continuing to pound away at North Vietnamese transportation and communication centers, curtailing the flow of food and consumer goods and people throughout the country, as well as war material in from China and the Soviet Union and out to the South Vietnam. And from communist capitals, especially Peking, but also Moscow, there came during this year muted but ever stronger criticism of the manner and the means by which General Giap was pursuing the war. So by the summer of 67, I think Giap decided that the time had come for him to take very decisive action. From documents captured later, it was clear that he believed, or said that he believed, that he could develop a campaign which would temporarily nullify the advantage which American technology provided the other side, which could cause the disintegration of the South Vietnamese armed forces and trigger a massive South Vietnamese civilian support movement. So the very broad characteristics of this campaign that he offered to the Politburo for approval was an intensification of medium size set piece battles, and numerous assaults on the cities, the airfields, military headquarters, logistic, transportation, communication network in the South, a stepped-up efforts against the GVN's pacification program, which the North Vietnamese had largely ignored up to this point, and new organizational efforts and increased motivational activities by Viet Cong cadres in the South. It was to be what Giap called the general offensive to culminate in a general uprising, Coi Nghĩa, as we saw last time. This would shunt aside American military prowess, would destroy the South Vietnamese armed forces as a coherent entity, and would leave the country at the end of the campaign largely in the hands of the National Liberation Front, probably in the form of a coalition government. It would be the decisive campaign of the year, of the war. Not that combat would be ended at the end of the period, which was June 30th, 1968, but that by that point time, a point of no return would be have been reached, and inexorably and irreversibly the war would begin to work itself out to inevitable victory. That is, fighting might continue, but there would be no longer, at the end of this, the outcome of the war would be no longer in doubt. Now, I'm reasonably sure, based on a lot of inferential evidence, that this is the basic argument that Jopp used to sell the plan to the Politburo, stressing above all its decisiveness, that this would be the final capper. It would be all over but the shouting when this, by June 30th, 1968. And anyway, it was approved by the Politburo in July 1967. As you can see on the board, it was divided into three phases. First phase stressed General Jopp called coordinated fighting methods. It was a fairly large attacks on fairly isolated enemy centers. These were the battles at Dak To, at Kong Tin, and at Lac Ninh, all of which you'll find listed here in your chronology. Pavan casualties were heavy in these. 5,000 were killed or permanently disabled at Dak To alone. But the first 3 months, ended inconclusively for General Jopp's purposes. Probably these battles increased the grumbling in the Politburo, particularly as the Pavan and PLAF professional, so-called professional generals in the South were reporting losing sizable numbers of good men without any very good purpose served, as far as could be told. These were all mountain battles, almost all of them, and they were large enough to extract real price, but they were too small to be decisive. However, the campaign went forward toward a major and hopefully a catastrophic blow against the enemy. Then came phase two, January, February, March 1968. This is the famed 1968 Tet Offensive, which people who don't know anything else about Vietnam know that there was a Tet Offensive. Tet is a Lunar New Year. It's the beginning of, it's a Chinese, Vietnamese, Japanese, Confucian New Year. So it begins at the dark of the first new moon of the new year. I mean, that's where the word Tet comes from. Phase two was characterized by increased use, or almost exclusive use, of what General Jopp called independent fighting methods. This is numerous small-scale attacks over the entire country. The crescendo of this started in the January dark of the moon, that is the 31st of January, 1968, and it launched 84,000 troops in 153 simultaneous attacks throughout all of South Vietnam, including 32 in, or again, attacks in the 32 largest, most populous population areas of the South, all the major cities and most of the district capitals. To the faithful, this was Armageddon. The general uprising had arrived at last. The war was now countrywide. By mid-February, General Jopp had 118,000 men in combat, half of his available force. Most of these were PLAF rather than Pavan. The latter were being held in reserve and is the source of a great deal of discontent among the Southern true believers down to the present day. I'll come back to that in a minute. Most of these attacks were quite small. There was only one squad against the American embassy in Saigon, less than 10 against the presidential palace, which was defended by six 50-caliber machine guns on the roof. I think about 900 against the Tan Son Nhut airfield complex. It must have had 40,000 troops defending it. So the point is that these were not meant to be, I mean, the concept here was not that you're trying to take and hold a specific installation. The concept was that you're turning the country into a sea of flames. attacks everywhere. And whether any one was very large or strategically, were not strategically significant, couldn't have been by the size of them. But they were noisy, they attracted world attention, they created this pattern of ubiquitous warfare. The assaults were everywhere, against air installations, military headquarters, governmental offices, logistics centers, and of course the major population centers. It had enormous, Tet Offensive had enormous psychological effect abroad, particularly in the United States, where it was a major factor in Lyndon Johnson deciding not to run for president second term. It also generated enormous social trauma in Vietnam. Now this this perception, and it was reality, but it was sort of only half the reality of the scene. But it was so overwhelming that it tended to obscure a central fact, which was that the winter-spring offensive was becoming carnage for the communists. In 1 month, 32,000 of the best PLAF troops were killed, and another 5,800 were captured. In fact, the PLAF never recovered from this, from the Tet Offensive, and it never amounted to much militarily in all the years that followed. Now, this was more dramatic, I think, at the time, because it was in stark contradiction to the accepted principles of revolutionary guerrilla war, which was still the major dominant, or still a major strategic concept at work in Vietnam. Cities are to be the last battle in this kind of war, not the first. Chinese understood this, of course, and the reaction by Peking during the Tet Offensive was sort of a thundering silence. You can almost, I think I've said in an earlier lecture, you could hear Mao Zedong, the great helmsman and author, architect of revolutionary guerrilla war, paraphrasing the French general who stood at the heights watching the charge of the Light Brigade, you know, and said, "It is magnificent, but it is not war." Mao saying, "It is magnificent, but it's not people's war." And Jop, of course, would say, "Well, this is the kind of war we have to fight here. You know, this is not China, and we can't do it the way you did against the Japanese. We have to do it my way." All right, then came phase three, April, May, June 1968. That phase, and not the Tet Offensive, was meant to be the final decisive ending of the campaign. Here would come an all-out military and political Dao Chan assault, what's called the continuous and comprehensive offensive, that would combine these two fighting methods, independent fighting method and coordinated fighting method. And then you'd put the two together, and you would build, as they say in the theater, until would finally come the great psychological shattering battle somewhere, the Dien Bien Phu Gambit, it was called later. The internal documents and radio intercepts and so on that we're getting on this referred to this in the code word as the second wave. That was the term that, and probably there were only two or three people in all of Vietnam, and they were all in Hanoi probably, who knew where the second wave was going to come. Some, because it never came, we to this day don't know where it was to have been. Some people believe it was to have been Hue, some believe that it was to have been Saigon itself. Still others, I think, thought that it was going to be Khe Sanh. Probably historians will judge, unless they get some hard evidence from Hanoi, that it probably was to be have been Khe Sanh. Anyway, as I say, it never eventuated, so we never knew what the second wave, or as the Americans in Saigon was calling it, the other shoe, was going to drop. The war now rose in phase three to the highest tempo ever, much greater than the Tet Offensive, greater than any time previous 8 years of combat. But it was going very badly on the battlefield for Hanoi. One of the techniques, as we saw last time on the American strategy, was the spoiling operation tactic which Westmoreland had developed, and which was never held with much respect. But I think military historians now are saying that regardless of whether Westmoreland knew exactly what he was doing or not, this tactic was indeed a proper one, and it did pay off. What was happening is that the North Vietnamese commanders were attempting, the Pavan commanders, to move their units into position to do a kind of coordinated fighting method battle, like they did in the first phase in the mountains at Doc Tho and Cong Tin and so on. But they found them consistently, when they would move into position, concentrate their forces, there they'd be confronting Allied forces. And the reason for this is that executing such maneuvers is moving several battalions over a period of several days in front of Wei, for example, in order to launch an attack, means that you tell a lot of people on that side what's going down. And that means that inevitably there are intelligence leaks. So time and time again, these Pavan commanders would move on an objective, and there they'd find enemy troops right in front of them who obviously knew what they were doing and where they were going and how they planned to. And of course, it was a spoiling operation that probably built on the techniques and the methods that were learned in the year or two up to this point, in which the Allied strategy was deliberately trying to get wind of these kind of operations and then spoil them. So this kind of spoiling operation happened between the DMZ and Wei. It happened in the Hai Van Pass area north of Da Nang, in the so-called Three Frontiers region near Pleiku, and most importantly between Zone D at the Cambodian border and Saigon. The Cambodian sanctuary area in Saigon. So what it came down to is the Pavan forces couldn't concentrate and get set in order to fight the kind of battle that they want. They got disrupted and scattered before they really got into position. It was a payoff for the spoiling tactics developed earlier. Now, the key to the entire campaign was to be this psychological back-breaking knockout, the second wave. As I say, it never took place, so we don't know to this day what it was. A bit more about the reaction to the political side of the Tet, or the Winter-Springer campaign, particularly the Tet offensive within it. Washington had been reassuring the American people that the communists were being beaten, pushed back toward the borders, and that the Allies were now firmly in command of the tempo of the war. And that was a light at the end of the tunnel, General Westmoreland said as he came home about Christmas time in 67, said it in a speech before Congress. And now, particularly in the Tet Offensive, these pictures were transmitted into the American living room. They raised all kinds of doubt. You know, there was combat in the front lawn of the American Embassy, and pictures that were really shocking because of their immediacy. And it was the first time television really had a chance to photograph the war in anything more than about a 2-second long shot. As we've said, seen earlier, the kind of war that was fought earlier was a quiet war, a scattered war, an episodic, sporadic war. And if you're lugging a camera around, and there's a 2-minute firefight out here in the tree line, even by the time you get out there, you're lucky that all you can photograph is some dead bodies. You can't get this kind of gripping action that the producers in New York television wanted. Now you could get it for about 3 days. And it made a tremendous impact on the U.S. in general, and Washington in particular. And I would say Washington's reaction to this, Lyndon Johnson's particularly, didn't help much. In a way, I mean, they were constant assertions that they, of the number of casualties that I've just given you, were being suffered by the other side, which were true. But that doesn't offset the picture that you see there in the image. And also, of course, the sheer number of American casualties, which had gone up very high, even though the ratio to the other side was impressive, didn't. Again, all that came across was that we were taking an awful lot of casualties when we'd been told that the war was practically over. So this was drawing a great deal of adverse comment, not just in the press, but on Capitol Hill and throughout the federal government, for that matter. So Washington tried to put on a good face, Lyndon Johnson particularly. But the fact is, we know from memoirs written later that they were, Johnson and most of the people around him, were really stunned by this, by the way the Tet Offensive within the Winter-Spring Campaign was unwinding. And I think, rightly or wrongly, they judged that this was, had put them past the point of no return. That is, that their reaction was pretty much the same reaction as everybody in the United States, and that put the war beyond the point where the Americans were now anything but utterly reluctant to back the war. So when Westmoreland and the Joint Chiefs of Staff asked for 200,000 more troops with the argument that this is the time to exploit enemy's weakness with counterattack, and that is exactly the strategy. When you're, in every war that we fought, Battle of the Bulge, Battle of Verdun, in World War I and World War II and World War I, when the enemy launches this major attack and fails, comes close but fails, Gettysburg too, after Gettysburg, then that's the time the other side just cranks up everything they got and they go after them, saying, okay, you guys want to fight? We'll give you a fight. It's a standard military response. So, I mean, Westmoreland was quite correct in his thinking. Give us more troops and this, we will do this. But what happened was, I don't think Lyndon Johnson thought much of this idea at all, but he appointed the Defense Secretary, Clifford Clark, to a special committee to study this request and sort of pass the blame around on the decision. I think it was foregone that they would turn Westmoreland down, but they needed a sort of finessed way of doing it. The report concluded that additional 200,000 troops would simply further Americanize the war, and it would not bring military victory any closer. And the second proposal had been made by some in Washington that the U.S. be put on a wartime basis. That is, it's a kind of technical condition, legal full mobilization, which happens in every war the United States fought, except in the Vietnam War. And that, of course, would have undercut all of the political programs which the administration had. And I think those who were against this simply argued that it wasn't necessary and it wouldn't do any good even if you did. Anyway, the buck stops at the president's desk, and it did here. He and Johnson agreed with the findings of the Clark-Clifford committee. He turned down the request for additional troops, and he announced a decision to seek a negotiated settlement with North Vietnam. This was all done on a March 31st, 1968, very dramatic television address. He announced a partial halt of bombings below above the 19th parallel against North Vietnam, and as a further, what he called a gesture to peace, his withdrawal from the 1968 presidential race. 3 days later, Hanoi accepted the presidential offer to begin talks. The talks bogged down in procedural wrangle for the rest of Johnson's presidential term, but Johnson did not give any serious thought to renewing the bombing. Nor did he approve the troop increase. There were about 30,000 U.S. troops in the pipeline at the time. But once that was run out, that was the end of the U.S. buildup. And no one in Vietnam would ever be encouraged by Washington again to believe that there were any kind of additional manpower would be forthcoming. The policy of gradual escalation had ended. And so, I think, most of the military in Vietnam concluded, so ended the prospect of achieving any kind of a military victory. The perceptions to the result of the winter-spring campaign varied, I think, as I've already suggested. In Hanoi, the political Dao Chun advocates, the Trung Chins in the Politburo, used it as an example of what could be accomplished of off-the-battlefield activity that would move the cause toward victory. So the irony here is that Jap sold this on the grounds of armed Dao Chun was going to do it, and you can almost hear Trung Chin coming into the next Politburo meeting and saying, "You see, that's what I'm talking about. You brought down the President of the United States, and you did it essentially through armed or political struggle means. This is a great political struggle." Well, Jap, of course, remained unimpressed. The book which he wrote that describes, sets down this strategy, it's called Great Victory, Big Task. And in it, he confronts as much as he can the political Dao Chun critics. Again, you remember, a political...